Welcome to a new episode of Electric Podcast. Hopefully people can hear me and see me right now.
Yes, we're live.
We're live? Okay, we are live. Perfect. We do apologize for last week's episode. It was last week's live stream, at least, that was got awful. We really got caught by surprise, but no, that's not fair. We wasn't caught by surprise by Google Hangout being discontinued. We knew it was coming, but we thought we had our other option in line, and we turns out that it was a bad choice. This thing seems to be working fine, though. This Jitsi live streaming app plus the YouTube live stream system. I still don't see us live, though, but I'm going to have to trust you on that.
Yeah, I'll send you the link. Yeah, the commenters are also saying we're live, so I'm pretty confident.
Oh, okay, so maybe I have the wrong link then that I can see.
Yeah,
that might be the issue here.
Also, turn off the audio of the QuickTime.
I think it's already turned off. Okay. Oh yeah. I see myself now. All right, we are indeed live, and everyone can hear us. All right, too. Audio is good this time. That's something we don't hear a lot around here.
Wow.
All right. Okay.
We spent like thousands of dollars on our new equipment, and everybody hates it.
Yeah, it's not like we're not trying, people. Especially Seth, he keeps buying new stuff all the time, trying to make it work. All right, so this week, what we're going to talk about this week? We're going to talk about some battery stuff for Tesla, which is always exciting because I think most people would agree, Seth, that Tesla is kind of the cutting edge of battery tech, right? Like, you know, you cannot think of another EV manufacturer right now has a more advanced battery pack.
I don't think there's anyone out there. You know, obviously in the labs at Panasonic and LG and Samsung and all the others, there's probably some interesting stuff going on. And I'm sure Tesla's got a pretty interesting lab as well. Mm-hmm. But as far as manufacturing battery packs, I don't think anybody else is close to Tesla.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many different metrics you can approach to approach battery packs. Of course, the easiest one is just looking at the energy capacity, like the kilowatt hour energy capacity of a pack, which doesn't tell you the whole story, of course. But still, Tesla still has the biggest battery pack in an electric car in production today. Though, of course, some automakers are getting close now. I mean, the closest one has to be the Audi e-tron with a 95 kilowatt hour battery pack, getting close to Tesla's 100 kilowatt hour. Yet, Audi also has its own issues with, they are big on limiting the battery capacity that you can access. They have a big buffer at the top and then at the bottom of the pack, which, if I remember correctly, is like 82 kilowatt hours, something like that, that are usable. But there's also, of course, the battery longevity. You want your battery to last many, many cycles. And so far, the degradation for Tesla has been very good. Aside from some examples.
A little lawsuit this week.
Yeah, that we're going to get into later. But that's more the exception that approved the rule. Because for the most part, Tesla's battery degradation has been very good. I mean, I have a car that's 6 years old now, and the battery pack is, I think, 4 years old on it, and it's still barely in the degradation. I'd still get like 96% of its original range or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of... I mean, Tesla's really the only company out there with large battery packs. I mean, obviously, there's Leafs and Volts and stuff out there, but they're the only company with large battery packs that have been out there for 5 or 6 years. And you can kind of see that the degradation in most cases is at most 5% or around there. So it's a pretty compelling thing because up until now, there's always been a, you know, well, how long is the battery pack going to last? I know Prius is like one of the things when you buy a Prius, it's always like, well, you're going to have to replace the battery pack or it's 8 years old. You need a new battery because those were, I think, nickel cadmium or something. So, it's good to see that these long-term tests with these huge battery packs are going well.
Yeah. And of course, the other metric is the cost, because you want your cars to be, other electric cars to be competitive with an internal combustion engine vehicle. And considering the percentage of the cost that it's related to the battery pack in an EV, you need to keep that down as low as possible in order to be competitive. And Tesla is believed to be the leader there too, both at the battery cell level and at the battery pack level. But Tesla is always also looking at the next thing. What's the next thing that's coming up? And one of our most popular articles this week was about a new research paper that was released by Jeff Down's team, along with Tesla's battery research group, which is a partner to Jeff Down at the Dalhousie University. I think Dalhousie, that's how you pronounce it. It's an university in Halifax where Jeff Down, which of course is a real pioneer in the lithium-ion battery cells chemistry. He's credited as one of the people that managed to push the technology further into conversation. So bringing the cost down, making the longevity better so that it becomes a viable product. And the research paper here, what it looks into really is a path for increasing the energy density of lithium-ion batteries while maintaining a liquid electrolyte and not going to a solid-state battery. And the conclusion of the paper, based on the prototype cells and the unveil, which it's called a dual salt lithium DFOB / lithium BF4 liquid electrolyte battery cell.
That sounds exciting.
Exciting and above my pay grade, really. I cannot get into too much of details. We posted the paper on Electrek, but they achieve with the battery cell. The numbers might not seem impressive right now, but again, it's a prototype cell. 80% capacity remaining after 90 charge-discharge cycle. Doesn't sound like a lot, but for a prototype cell with that, the most important thing is that they deliver it with zero excess lithium, and it doesn't have the dendrite that happened with that number of discharge normally for a cell of that energy density. So you can they see a clear path based on that cell chemistry for a lithium cell that can reach a high number of charge without too much degradation, which a much higher energy capacity, energy density comparable to a solid state cell. And their conclusion with the paper is that they see a path now for research to shift, because the next gen battery research right now, I think people are, what we get from the industry is that people are really focusing on solid state cells. The most people agree also that, of course, the lithium ion cell is there to stay for a decent period of time, at least 5 to 10 years. But they see that there's going to be a shift at some point to those solid state cell when we do figure out that this dendrite issue and long term, well, reducing the cost too, I think is a big concern. And you want those advantage from solid state at the energy density level, at the charging discharge level, and some people also say in terms of safety, it's less prone to catching on fire, to having a thermal discharge. But there is a way to make your battery packs now with lithium-ion cells that is also very secure. I mean, Tesla had their fair share of battery fires. But what we're seeing, though, with the battery fire is that it's almost only effect. Not almost. I think so far we haven't seen any example of a Model 3 battery fire, so it's only affect Model S and Model X. And Tesla now has almost as many Model 3s as they have Model S's on the market. If you add Model X, they still have a little way to go, but we should have seen probably some Model 3 fires. I think it's clear that the Model 3 battery pack architecture and probably the cells too are a little bit more secure now. So anyway, the conclusion of the paper is that now some of the research should shift back into lithium ion, because if we focus still on that, there's still enough room for improvement to maybe make solid state even either irrelevant or at least maybe push their conversation again a few years more. And the of course, the biggest advantage of that is that you would retain all the production capacity that we have right now for lithium ion cells. We could convert them with this new chemistry, which is not as disruptive as a solid state manufacturing process. So Tesla, I think Tesla is a bit partial to this, of course, because they have already invested a lot in lithium ion cell production through their partnership at the Gigafactory 1 with Panasonic. So, of course, they kind of would prefer it to be the main battery cell chemistry, at least base chemistry going forward, or at least for a decent period of time. People also linked it though, like, okay, they want that, but then there's also the dry electrode process with, okay, can it be included in into that same, lithium metal pouch, cell? That's again above my pay grade. It's a little bit complicated, but, I think considering that, I mean, Tesla invested a lot in partnership with Jeff Dahn and his team here with the paper coming out, and Tesla is directly also mentioned in the paper, but, I think more recently Tesla did invest a lot more money in Maxwell's dry electrode technology with the $200-something million buyout. So if there's one thing that I think is going to come out of Tesla's battery research in the short term, that's going to be more Maxwell thing. Though they could be linked together also, like I said, I'm not well versed enough.
I thought one thing interesting is that it's a anode-free lithium metal pouch cells. So would they be changing the form factor as well? I mean, these are not like things that you can.
I think that's just for the prototype though.
Oh, just for the prototype.
Gotcha. Yeah, I don't think.
So they would go back to cells.
Yeah, the chemistry can still be applied to a roll instead of a pouch format. I don't think that makes a big difference for them. And speaking of Jeff Dahn, he was also in the news this week because he gave a rare interview with the YouTuber Sean Mitchell. And the interview was kind of strange a little bit because, I mean, Jeff Dahn, to give him credit, he's known in the entire, especially the academic world and the battery world. But, I mean, more recently for the wider public, he's been known as like this the Tesla battery research partner, really. And yet in the interview, Tesla wasn't mentioned at all. So it looks pretty clear that, like, he made it clear to Sean that it was, even though Sean didn't say that, it sounds like it was off the table, really.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that was pretty obvious that he could talk about Tesla, but it was even more obvious when given the opportunity to talk about vehicle manufacturers that were making their own batteries, like, you know, kind of throwing him the softball there. He, instead of saying, well, Tesla that I work for does that, he went to BYD, makes their own batteries.
Yeah, is that right? He didn't say that. So, I mean, he was recently in China for a battery thing too, so I'm sure that BYD was involved with that. So
right.
That might be where the... and also to BYD's credit, I would describe them as more of a battery manufacturer than Tesla is, because they do really manufacture their home battery cells themselves. And
right, they don't have a partner like Panasonic.
It's not like Tesla's partnership with Panasonic, though we do think that Tesla is going to soon announce the manufacturing of their own battery cells, either completely on their own or at least being more involved than they are now with Panasonic. But that's another story. So, I mean, if you want to talk to someone about who knows battery cells and lithium-ion battery cells, Jeff Dahn is definitely on top of your list there. And he had some interesting stuff to say, especially when it came to the path to $100 per kilowatt hour at the cell level. And he didn't want to make his own projection, but instead he took someone else's projection. He said, I agree with those, which says in the next few years. He agrees that we're basically there already. And Tesla's been talking about getting there by the end of the year. And then they also said the original timeline was before either 2020 or before 2020. I wasn't sure. So, well,
I feel like Elon has mentioned, like, you know, in passing a few times that they're approaching 100.
Yeah, without ever confirming it. But the most recent deal was a big increase in production capacity. In Gigafactory 1 went from like 23 gigawatt hour to 28 gigawatt hour in a few months. That's pretty significant. So And of course, economies of scale, 5 gigawatt hour per year annual production rate difference, that kind of thing is a big deal. So I wouldn't be too surprised if they were very close to that right now. He also talked about other things like removing cobalt from battery cell, which he sees as something that's very possible now. And of course, Tesla wasn't mentioned about that, but it is one of Tesla's goals to. They already have much less cobalt as a percentage of the entire cell, but their goal is to remove it completely from the cell. And he also, I found that he was really, he had very similar talking points as Elon Musk when it comes to batteries, where he doesn't like a lot of the most recent research, where he says it's kind of too easy to do the research. They should really produce prototypes. And of course, they just released a research paper in Nature, but it didn't include a prototype of a cell. So if you look at the most recent patents that he filed with Tesla, well, not just him personally, but his research group in Dalhousie, it has a lot to do also with understanding battery cells, like its equipment to measure the capacity of the cells and things like that to a higher degree than that's been done before. So you see that I think that Don is probably the guy when Tesla gets a new cell, a new research group or a startup, or even like in maybe a new Panasonic cell that they're working on, because of course Panasonic is not sitting on their hands, and they're also trying to improve. I'm pretty sure that Jeff Dunn gets one of those prototypes to test and see if they're really up to the standards.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff must be a very next level impressive person, because he's able to wield the power that, hey, I'm not even going to move to California. I'm going to stay in Nova Scotia and do my research from here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure he makes trips, but I feel like if Tesla was going to hire somebody, they would want them to come to California in almost any other kind of situation ever.
Well, I think there's advantage to be still in the academic world.
Right.
I mean,
and a lot of access to smart people.
Yeah, exactly. They want those PhDs and those grad students working on project that, a lot of things come out of those young talents that are just hungry for stuff and they're thinking different ways. So I think there's a big advantage to still be in the academic world. So probably why Don wanted to stay in the first place, most likely, and Tesla allowed it and still gave him the contract. So because it originally was a 3M contract that he had with his lab for 20 years, I think, so in a very long-term contract, and then it switched 2 or 3 years ago to Tesla. Yeah, we referenced it a little bit earlier briefly, but battery degradation, though it's not really battery degradation. Well, to the customers it is, but we reported on that a few months ago, where there was a software update, 2019.16.1 and 2.2 was also an issue. And a few Model S and X owners with the 85 kilowatt-hour battery pack, so older Model S and X, they when they got the update, they saw their range drop significantly. And we talked to one of them owners. There was hundreds of reports, and we think that the entire lot's probably like in the high hundreds or low thousands, something like that, like single digit thousands. And for Rasmussen, for one of those owners, David Rasmussen, it was his range went from 247 miles to 217 miles at a full charge. So an 11% drop due to the software update, 30 miles lost due to that software update. So it's pretty significant. And he has been plotting his degradation, and there was somewhat consistent degradation over, especially from about 90,000 miles to 90,000 miles to about 130,000 miles, but then it dropped very fast. Before that, it was in the 5 miles range. So 5 miles range over 50,000 miles, 40,000 miles.
Not bad.
To 30 miles in just a few 1,000 miles and a few software upgrades. So,
I mean, this says estimated 100% range. Do you think he was charging his car to 100% every time? Was he just not giving it any buffer? I mean, how do you...
It doesn't necessarily mean that. It could be, though. But it could have been just plotting based on the percentage of the battery pack versus your range shown.
Because that could be kind of misleading, because maybe Tesla, like, if you want to go to 100%, would still give you the 255, 265, whatever. And then, you know, day-to-day wants you to be down in the 217 range for safety reasons or whatever.
Yeah, but it's not that in this case here, because
it's pretty significant.
Bunch of owners got the same issues. Tesla wasn't saying anything. We did a report on them. Tesla got back to us. Tesla said that it was indeed due to the software update, and they said it was to protect, I'm quoting here, protect the battery and improve battery longevity. That was the reason. It said it only affect a small percentage of owners, whatever. And then they said they were working on a solution. That was back in June. So nothing happens for months. And some of the owners, of course, weren't happy about that, and rightfully so, I think. And one of them, which is, of course, David Rasmussen, who also contacted us about, give us all the good data about that stuff in June, he filed a class action lawsuit this week against Tesla over the issue. And there's the class action lawsuit is kind of is a bit complicated. We posted the whole thing on Electrek, but it's hard to get through the whole thing because, I mean, it's written by lawyers and whatnot. And, but the bulk of it really is that, of course, he wants his range back, or he wants like a battery pack replacement or something like that, since he thinks that it's really Tesla that forced that on him for a reason. And the reason that he doesn't know exactly, because the only communication that Tesla did about it was that the comment they did to us a few months ago, protect the battery and improve battery longevity. Doesn't tell him, what do you need to protect the battery now? What happened that makes you need to protect the battery? And in the lawsuit, he infers that the software update came around the same time as there was a few battery pack fires with Tesla vehicles. And Tesla admitted that they did push a software update around the same time that included things to improve, to make the battery safer against a problem with battery fires. And if you look at what the update did, it basically capped the charge of the cells 90%, so you cannot charge, they give a bigger battery buffer basically to the battery cells. And that thing also affect like charging. So his charging is also limited now because he gets closer to the 100% faster, even though there's a bigger buffer. So it's really not great. And he filed a class action lawsuit. No, so win or lose, that lawsuit is going to be, I think, expensive to deal with. Tesla's going to have to put a bunch of manpowers in terms of lawyers on that stuff. And I think it's sad because they probably could have avoided the whole thing just by having better communication, like actually talking to those owners, not just having to go through Electrek and stuff like that to give information, and something better than just saying to protect the battery and improve battery longevity. Like, explain exactly why you did that. You did that. Why does it affect only a few? A bunch of owners with 85 kilowatt battery pack. So what happened with that 85 kilowatt battery pack? Do you need to do a recall?
It sounds like you might need to do a recall.
I mean, yeah, it sounds like they found a way to avoid a recall more than anything else. So,
well, how small is the subset? I mean, I feel like we need to know numbers there.
I mean, just with the...
I mean, was it a paltry, like, battery management controller that is in, you know, 200 cars? Or is it, you know, the whole 85 kilowatt hour?
There's too many 85 kilowatt hour battery pack for that to be the case. I think they would be
way more important. You have an 85, right?
I have an 85, yeah, but it has to be because even the 85 kilowatt hour battery pack, there's a bunch of different version of it. There's a bunch of different iterations, so it might. And I didn't get the software update, so I don't think I'm in.
And are you going to install it if you do get it?
I mean, do I have a choice? I don't know. Like, but it was months ago now. I think it started going out in March or something.
Right.
So it's been a while. I would have gotten it by now. So yeah, then Tesla, after my report, Tesla did end up commenting on this lawsuit. They said that, well, they disagree with the way that it's maintained in the lawsuit, that they don't really care about their customers and everything, which, I mean, hard point to make if you didn't really communicate with them. They reiterate that it's a small percentage of Model S owner that adds notice a small reduction. And they really, I really don't like the comment because they are minimizing the issue. I mean, I put myself in the shoes of those owners. I'll be pissed too to let Tesla just push the software out there. And 30 miles of range of my car is reduced. It's a big deal for long distance travel. If you do often long distance, the 30 miles makes a big difference.
Also, when you sell your car, you just lost some significant value.
Good point. That's right too. And then finally, what they say is that, they said again, now they removed the protect the battery pack thing. They said it was to improve battery longevity. So now they just mentioned that, okay. Well, but then they said, as previously noted, we have been working to mitigate the impact on the range for these owners and have been rolling out over-the-air updates to address this issue since last week. So they started pushing that stuff since last week, but those owners didn't know. No one knew until that post. And I talked again to Rasmussen, who said that if he did get the update, it didn't have any impact on his range. I did reach back to Tesla to ask what they meant by mitigating the impact on the range, and no answer. So I don't like using the legal system for stuff like that, but at this point, I cannot blame the guy because Tesla is just not communicating right, and I don't like the conspiracy theory stuff, anything like that. But it does look like Tesla is hiding something if they're not willing to communicate what is happening clearly. So there might be a problem with those packs that they are covering up a little bit with that. I mean, if it's a very small percentage of owner, like replace the pack if you need to. Like, it's not going to kill the company.
Yeah, and if it is something that they need to dial back, then, you know, and customers are okay with, you know, give them a bonus of, you know, free self-driving or whatever to mitigate the price change.
You think people would take that?
I don't think many people would take that, but like
no, something. they would want a new battery pack,
right?
I mean, Rasmussen apparently to give him credit before. Finding that lawsuit, he did reach out to Tesla a bunch of times, to the service center and everything. We at this point were aware of the issue, and they asked him, like, he proposed, give me a refurbished battery pack instead, which has similar value that my 85 kilowatt battery pack had before, that just doesn't have that issue that required that software update that only his car and the other very small percentage of car have been affected. So and Tesla, of course, said no. What's crazy is that the service center operator told them to, you should just stop using climate control when you need to do long distance and things like that. Because he said it's a similar, the percentage of the battery pack that was affected is a similar percentage that the climate control affects on a long distance trip. So you should just do that instead. So Tesla is basically telling him, well, if you don't want your range to be crippled, instead just don't use climate instead. Like, either you lose your range or lose climate control. That's not a solution.
No.
Anyway, that was disappointing. Hopefully Tesla wakes up and do the right thing here.
Well, I mean, theoretically, maybe they'll be able to dial it back a little bit. And, you know, maybe they were just like, look, cut off all access to like 10% of the battery. And then they'll say, well, maybe, you know, 8% is fine.
Something still like a big deal, though. You're still losing 8% of your range for
right.
Because there's apparently something that Tesla just found, because it's something new. It's something that Tesla just pushed that. So there's something that happened to those pack that we don't know, but and those owners didn't know when they bought the car. So it's something new that happened. Of course, Tesla doesn't, on the warranty, they don't put battery degradation, or at least not for Model S and X back then. Now they do for Model 3, but I think they still don't for Model S and X. I need to look into that. But back then, they certainly didn't from all S and X. So, could they put a software update? Could they squeeze a software update in that? Because it's not battery degradation based on regular wear and tear, not based on, oh, we found out something new about the pack and now we're pushing a software upgrade to lock some capacity. It's really a strange issue that plays both into battery degradation, which we don't know that much because electric vehicles are still relatively new, and at the same time, Tesla's over-the-air software update business model, which for the most part is great, but with things like that, it just it creates some very strange situations. All right, moving on. We had a report yesterday about we found out about a new R&D lab and vehicle testing facility that Tesla is building in Fremont. So we obtained some plans, some construction plans that Tesla filed with the city of Fremont. And some old school Tesla owner might remember this facility. It's the 47400 Cato Road, which is just south of the Fremont factory. And way back, Tesla was building the biggest supercharger in the world there. And it took forever to build, and it was never completed. And at the end, they just deconstructed it. They removed all the stalls and everything, and it was never open. It was a really weird that we didn't never really understand why they did that. But instead, they added more supercharger to the Fremont factory.
Weren't some of those stalls available on eBay? Like, you could buy the stalls. Somebody like just dumped.
I know that some stalls ended up on eBay, but I'm not sure they were from that location. Make sense.
They were the old kind, you know, like the spacey looking ones.
No. Those were the one that you see today.
Okay.
Yeah, they removed it like a year or two ago. The location is officially listed as a warehouse, but they also at that time they planned to do a service center there, a little showroom, a bunch of offices. And it would be the service training location. So that's where they will train new service technician. Now they're requesting a different zoning for it for different use case. And instead it would become a big vehicle testing area. Future R&D lab. And what they call it? They call it a future energy reliability lab, as well as some offices and stuff. The biggest portion would be the vehicle testing area, and it would include things like a crash track, a crash sled, a test chamber, vehicle lifts, and labs. So apparently things to test the reliability of Tesla's cars, and of course the safety of it with crash test result. And the R&D space would be equipped with vehicle lifts, test chambers, workshops, and storage. And that's for vehicles. So there's going to be some vehicle R&D there, but it's also going to be some energy R&D done at the Future Energy Reliability Lab, which is going to include some test chambers or workshop and solar energy product testing equipment. So they would test new solar energy product there for reliability, which I assume is probably especially for the solar roof, which they need a lot of reliability tests for that to test the longevity of it and whatnot.
Speaking of solar roof, this thing has quite a big solar roof, according to the pictures here.
Yeah, well, solar panels. Right. I was talking about the solar roof tiles, yeah, of course.
I know.
But yeah, it has a major solar panel installation. Yeah, definitely thousands. Yeah, because it's a big building. It's a 300,000 square foot building.
Right, and that's not cheap in the valley there.
Nope, no.
Or Fremont's a little cheaper, but still not cheap.
No. Yeah, so a major lab for Tesla is going to be over 250 people is going to work there, according to the filing that we obtained.
And how far is it from the factory?
I think it's about a mile. It's pretty close. And, of course, I think it's all linked to Elon's goal to having the car last for 1 million miles. They really want to make their car more reliable. Of course, also to reduce service. Elon has been pushing the idea recently that the best service is no service, and you shouldn't just simply don't have to go to the service center. So that thing also, to achieve that, you need to make the vehicle more reliable. And it's a bit ironic that he says that, then he literally putting the place that he wanted to train service technician at, and he's replacing it with a reliability lab, R&D lab. So, I mean, he's taking things quite literal. And Elon already claims that the Model 3 was designed to last 1 million miles, except for the battery modules, which are made to last 300,000 to 500,000 miles. But he's been teasing that new battery pack is going to last 1 million miles as soon as next year. So probably it's going to be tested there too.
It's probably being tested there already.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those filings were just were filed with Fremont last month. So I don't know what's the status of construction there, but probably takes a little bit more than a month to get that thing up and running. All right. Elon yesterday started talking again about the V10, the version 10 of Tesla software update, which is apparently coming as soon as this month. A bit surprising because Tesla's full number revision were always a few years apart. 2000, the version 8, I think, was 2016. And then 2000, version 9 was released just September, October of last year. And now version 10 would be almost to the day a year later, so a lot faster. But I don't think it's going to be you could argue on that. Not really as significant as the last one. Normally with the full number revision, they always have a new UI and everything like that on top of new features. He's not talking about a new UI here for V10, but it's going to come with a bunch of new features. He again hyped up the streaming, the in-car video streaming capacity and the karaoke, like a play on the word karaoke. But he said that especially the video streaming is going to be amazing with the Tesla sound system, of course, and it's going to get the cinematic feel to it. He said it's going to be released to early access owner soon. Now, that brings us to who's on the early access program now, which is kind of a bit of confusing because he's been promising the all FSD owner to be on the early FSD owner to compensate for the fact that they given Tesla thousands of dollars and never got anything out of it for some of them for years now, really. So,
Are you an FSD owner?
I am an FSD owner, but not for years. I mean, I think I bought it in February when the price went down.
Yeah.
But today he said that all FSD owners are going to be on the early access program.
We'll see.
What I don't get from that is that he has to create two tiers now for the early access program. Because the real early access program, it's really beta testers, really. Well, although you can argue that this is also beta test in-house before going to the early access program, but it's very much beta tester. Sometimes it lasts for months. A good example would be now the enhanced summon thing. This lasts for months. Normally, they have to sign NDAs, and they have to provide feedback to you about the features and everything. So Tesla tried to create this close, very short feedback loop, which is great. But now, if you're going to put the FSD owners on this, you're literally adding thousands, if not tens of thousands of owners to that program. And are you going to make these people sign NDAs? Are you going to make them provide feedback all the time? That'd be that would increase the workload related to the early access program quite significantly. So I doubt it. That's going to be the same. I think it's going to be a different tier of early access program. All right. Speaking of full self-driving, this week Tesla confirmed that they're going to increase the price again on August 16. And they did that in a little marketing mishap, if you want to ask me, because the price was lowered last month, and it wasn't apparently lowered, especially for enhanced autopilot owners who were offered for enhanced autopilot owner, they had to pay $6,000 now to get the FSD price, and all the features in FSD were the features that were originally in the enhanced autopilot feature, aside from of course the future stuff that we don't know when they're going to come out just yet, but all the things like on-ramp, off-ramp, merge and exit, auto park, summon, all that stuff, they were already promised that in Autopilot, so they already paid for that. So Tesla gonna make them pay for it again, but yet they put that now in the full self-driving package. So for it was very hard for an Autopilot owner to decide to upgrade, because you feel like you're just paying again for features that already paid for, more than actually paying for future features that you don't exactly know when you're going to get. And then Tesla said that they're going to increase that price of the feature. So you don't want to wait either if you think that Tesla's going to eventually deliver those features. So they put them in a very weird spot. So what Tesla did is that they lowered that price to $3,000. And they didn't say clearly that it was temporary, but we knew that it was a short period of time to make those people upgrade. But then in the marketing campaign to make those people upgrade, they sent an email to us, and Autopilot owners. And in the email, they straight up say, you can upgrade now for just $3,000 until August 16, when we're going to increase the price. And you should do that because you're going to get Navigate on Autopilot, on and off ramp, amp, interchange, emerges and exits, auto park and summon, all features that all enhanced Autopilot owners already have. So
right.
If you're not following Tesla closely and you just get that update, you're like that email, you're like, why would I do that? Why would I upgrade at all? This makes no sense. I mean, Tesla, well, they do also mention future self-driving features. So that's the only mention of something else that is going to come. But I think Tesla should say things like, they promise a retrofit to the Hardware 3 FSD computer if you buy the FSD package. So I think that should be in there. They should say, hey, if you want to eventually get the new computer retrofit, pay $3,000 and you're going to get it the next year or so, whatever that comes out. Though Elon said it should be like in a few months away, I think. He said
they should tell you exactly when you're going to get it, because
Tesla giving you an exact timeline.
Right. I know.
What world have you been living in?
Well, they should give you some sort of like, hey, we're really going to roll this thing out at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I find it so hard to recommend people to buy the FSD package, okay, for this reason. But Tesla's pricing structure is always extremely difficult to follow. But I think I'm one of the most educated person on the price changing of Tesla, because I report on all of them, so I can discern the patterns and everything. And right now, I'd be willing to bet that that's going to be the lowest price of FSD going forward. So
you're saying I should buy it?
I'm saying that if you believe in Tesla's capability of delivering future FSD features, like Elon has been saying, then you should buy it, because that's going to be the cheapest you're going to sell them.
But what if I'm going to trade for a Model Y next year? Should I just go status quo and then?
Yeah, that's a good question. Probably you should.
What's annoying, though, is like you buy FSD and it doesn't travel with you to your like next Tesla. So you have to rebuy it.
Yeah, you have to rebuy it. And then you have to assume that buying it now on your car is going to increase the resale value of it.
Right. I mean, it will if you trade it to somebody else, but if you give it back to Tesla, they're probably not going to care if you have
FSD. It will if you trade somebody else, if there's a belief in FSD, because right now It's all based on belief. It's all based, the value of FSD is based on, do the market believes that Tesla is going to deliver those features
right. With
the hardware and everything. So
yeah, and as Cedric Bernstein says in the chat room, like, they're going to deliver it. Like, I believe they're going to deliver it, but very few people. Even Lex Friedman on that chat with what's his name?
George Hotz.
George Hotz last night was like, yep, Tesla's way ahead, but 2020, nobody's believing that.
So. Even him, he said, we're going to be 2 years behind Tesla whenever Tesla delivers. And I don't know when they're going to deliver, but we're going to be 2 years behind them. I don't get the logic there, though. So are you like copying Tesla and it takes you 2 years to copy them?
That's what I mean. That was kind of in the context of like what he reverse engineers everything. So maybe that's what he was implying.
But basically, because otherwise it doesn't make sense at that timeline. Like, are you like so confident that you're always just 2 years behind Tesla? So whenever they deliver, you're going to be 2 years. But if you don't have yourself a timeline and you're basing it on Tesla's, I don't get that logic at all.
Yeah, but they said 2020. They were both like, both of them are big Tesla fans, big Elon Musk fans. And they were both like, 2020, just doesn't feel realistic at all.
Yeah. I don't, and Freeman, I think, is a lot more skeptical about the whole level 5 self-driving. I think he heard him for like decades or something like that. Like, he's not
right.
But at the same time, he's a big AI guy, and if you figure out AI, then you basically figure out
everything.
Like, if you figure out general AI, you figure out self-driving too. I mean, so right. I don't know. So weird, but. My point is that it's not gonna be get cheaper than that. All right, I think the biggest story of the week in not for electric specifically, but in the media in general, I saw it everywhere throughout the entire week, was the whole NHTSA stuff about NHTSA saying that Tesla was misleading about their claims for safety ratings of the Model 3 last year. That came out of a Plain Sight report. Well, Plain Sight got. Freedom and Information Act. They got a bunch of documents from NHTSA about Freedom of Information Act request, and some of those reports show that NHTSA sent a cease and desist to Tesla and Elon Musk about the way they were representing their safety rating for the Model 3, which they said had the lowest probability of injury of any car tested by NHTSA after they released their 5-star rating of the car after their crash test last year. That was in October of last year that Tesla made the claim. And of course, the bulk of the stories around the fact that Tesla said that claim was misleading. They don't want Tesla to present their safety rating like that. That's what they don't want. So I think there's that story has been misconstrued as saying that Tesla has been like lying or stuff like that about their safety rating, which is not the case. And NHTSA is not saying that. NHTSA is being a little bit weird here, where Tesla is claiming that based on the data that NHTSA released, and they are interpreting the data right. It looks like based on NHTSA's data, Tesla indeed has the lowest probability of any car tested by lowest probability of injury than any car tested by the agency. However, the guidelines that NHTSA provide on how to advertise your safety rating that based on their test is that you can only use their 5-star rating system. So that's the thing. They're not saying that what you're saying is wrong. Is that what you're saying is not how we present vehicle safety data. But the way NHTSA presents vehicle safety data based on a 5-star rating is kind of dumb, because like 40% of the car get the 5-star rating. So how do you are really like 40 the top 40% of car just there's no difference between all of them. They're just 5-star, so they just as good. Tesla argue that's not the case, and of course, Tesla also delivered their own kind of misleading charts at the same time with the lowest probability of injury. They did that thing where they closed down the range of a chart a lot closer to make it like the difference be bigger. Like the other like next 50 cars, they look like a big difference, but actually it's like a less than a 3% difference, which it can be significant. Like if you have like a lot of accident, a large fleet, a lot of accident, a 3% lower injury rate makes a big difference. So we have to take that into consideration. But I think that story has blown up bigger than it should be, where, yeah, NHTSA is not happy the way Tesla is advertising their rating, but they're not saying that it's not true or anything like that. All right, next story. VW sees electric car price parity coming soon. And they see it as the last thing to make it a tipping point for EV adoption. Honestly, it's something that we've been saying at Electric like forever.
Right.
It's something that we all agree with, that price. And to a degree, we could even make the argument that price parity is already here for some segment. Example, Model 3. If you look at the pricing in the Model 3, it's very competitive in its own segment.
Well, if you include... So, like for economical cars, when price is a bigger piece of the puzzle, it doesn't really necessarily make sense. But if you include all the advantages to EVs, including the very fast acceleration, you know, all the clean stuff, like the nice things about EVs, then I think you're already at price parity. I think, you know, a Model 3 versus a BMW 3 Series is a great example. Like, most people would rather have a Model 3. I think BMW is finding that out right now. But as you move
down, that's my point, though. So just compare the 3 Series prices and feature with a Model 3. Not the feature, just the price of the BMW 3 Series and the Model 3. It's still comparable in price in the same segment.
Right.
I mean, then you look at the specs, and the specs are more interesting for the Model 3.
Yeah,
but I think that's the price point, the price parity they're talking about.
Right. But then there's a lot of other stuff, like BMW would say, hey, we were putting a lot more money into the interior, of the car. Okay, like, yeah. We've got like super nice leather and wood finish and tons of buttons everywhere. And so it's complicated, but I think...
Yeah, it's subjective at that point.
Right. But, overall, I think we're getting very close. And I guess the best way to kind of gauge that, or one way to gauge that, is these cars that have like 3 powertrains and one... in one model, like the Hyundai does this a lot with the Ioniq and the they have Ioniq plug-in hybrid, and then they have an Ioniq hybrid, and obviously the regular hybrid is way cheaper because they don't have batteries to deal with, and their motors are the gas motors are very small and crappy. So once the electric version costs the same or very close to the gas model, then we'll be at parity.
Yeah, that's fair. Though my only problem, I'm glad that VW is recognizing that and it's saying it out loud and everything, but my only problem with it is that if you recognize that, then why are they still planning for the minority of their car to be all electric like 5 to 10 years from now?
Why are they planning any gas cars 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, where are you working R&D right now on new gasoline car models? Like, yeah, that's a direct loss, really.
I mean, if you truly believe it in your heart, and this guy is probably like the head of the EV division, and there's plenty of other guys who are not in the EV division who are like, that guy's lunatic.
He's actually the head of strategy for North America for VW.
So all of strategy.
Yeah. Well, that's what made that article more interesting, where he's the head of strategy for VW America, and VW is not really focusing their electrification strategy on North America. They are more bigger in Europe and China. Biggest example is that we're not going to get, at least in the near future, the ID3 that's coming out later this year in Europe. So big bummer, because I think a lot of people would prefer that over the e-Golf by a wide margin. All right, still on Volkswagen. Porsche Taycan, they got our friends at Fully Charge. They gave them a test, well, not a test drive, really. There was a lot of limitation. It was basically just launches on the strip, straight launches. So it's not like a full review of the drive, but they let him drive it to test. What Porsche wanted out of this is that for them to show the the repeatability, is that it? Is that right?
Repeatability?
Repeatability of the high performance power output of the car. It's something that Porsche has been talking about for a while now, where they say that the kind of betting on it as the differentiating factor against Tesla's performance vehicle, where, I mean, Tesla's performance vehicle are extremely performant. Like, it's like nothing come close to it. So it sounds like they are trying to find like a weakness to them to see how we're better than them there. And what they think they found is the repeatability of the power output. Whereas when Tesla goes full power, they cannot do it for a long period of time. They can't do it too many times. You cannot do too many launches. They only let you achieve full power output with, when you activate like Ludicrous Plus mode and you do launch mode at the same time. For the Porsche Taycan, for that video, Fully Charged was only doing launch modes too. They were only using that. But to their credit, Johnny Smith from Fully Charged said that they did 30 launches and the car was still doing 10 seconds, 0 to 200 kilometers an hour in 10 seconds. So that's 124 miles per hour.
And I think that's a little bit faster than P100, right? To that speed? Isn't a P100 like a little bit over 10 seconds?
I think it's still in the 10 seconds.
Yeah. But the Porsche
maybe 11. Well,
Porsche has late. A two-speed gearbox. So
yeah, apparently that's all they do. That and all they do also maintain a top speed easier. And just under 10 seconds, they say here.
Yeah, and
because the Porsche also released a press release based on, which is kind of weird. Like, you don't see that often because, officially, like, they are independent journalists, fully charged. But then Porsche, they gave them the exclusive of driving the car, and then Porsche released a press release based on fully charged tests. So, kind of a weird thing. But we posted both on Electric so you can get both takes on it. But yeah, it looks like it's indeed repeatable. High power output of the car. However, like, if you don't use, you take a Model S with Ludacris and you just don't use the Ludacris Plus, you just put it in Ludacris mode and you do a bunch of launches, your launch is going to be faster than this, at least for the 0 to 60. Or, well, that's also, they never actually released the data on it. Like, Fully Charged said faster than 3.5. But what was that?
Yeah, faster between 3 and 3.5 seconds, which is fast, clearly. Like, everybody's going to be fine with that. Not everybody, but it's not even close to the Model S.
But Model S can do 2.4, of course.
Right. It's a whole second slower.
But that's with the Ludacris Plus that is not as repeatable as this.
Right.
Granted. So that's where Porsche doesn't have attached. But then you just go to Ludacris. I think you can get 3 seconds still with just a Ludacris on that same car.
I don't even.
And that you can repeat a lot more.
Yeah, you don't even need the Ludacris mode. You can get the P100D, not Ludacris, car and still get 3 seconds.
So, like, then what's the advantage? I'm not exactly sure on it.
Well, I guess, you know, after a while, Tesla will slow down.
Go to low power mode.
Lower power mode, right.
So, but how fast is going to do that versus how it's going to affect the Porsche? I think the test is cool.
That's a very narrow use case, I think.
Yeah, but it's not, we need a lot more data to really claim that I think it might be more capable of maintaining higher power output for a period of time, but I'm not declaring it based on that just yet. We'll have to get a lot more tests than that to see. But either way, I'm still extremely excited about the take-in. I mean, I just the car that Fully Charged tested, unfortunately, was still all camouflage and everything, and it couldn't show the interior and whatnot. But I'm still very excited to see that production car next month when it comes out. It's not quite the Mission E, which of course was absolutely stunning, but it's still going to be quite impressive. I think I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, and so in addition to that, they apparently there's some rumors that F1 driver and Porsche fan Mark Webber, who's the other guy who's driven a Porsche outside of the company.
I agree with Johnny's claim that he's the first non-Porsche employee because Mark Webb, I think, is an official sponsor. He's being sponsored by Porsche. It's basically
right, and he's an F1 driver, so he's not like a normal human. my understanding is that Porsche is going to have an event in Berlin on September 4th, rather than, I don't know if you got the tip, but I saw something about this before. So on September 4th, which is right at the beginning of IFA, which is a tech summit that I'm actually going to be at, Porsche is going to have an event in Berlin and hopefully I'll be at that. But what's interesting is this tip says there's also going to be a simultaneous event in China and Canada.
Oh,
so maybe there's some other opportunities for simultaneous, intercontinental, watching of a Porsche debut on September 4th.
So that might be crazy. So you might be in Berlin getting a first look at the show, and might be in Canada getting a first look of it. But yeah, it's a simultaneous. So it's not a simultaneous event. But it's not about like a live stream or something like that. So they're going to have three events at the same time. Why Canada?
I don't know.
Because China, I get used market for Porsche. Berlin, I get home market for Porsche. Canada,
you know, maybe I just mean,
I would think Norway before that or the U.S.
Well, you know,
although Norway doesn't make as much sense because they're already in Berlin, so
they probably just see it as one big North American market.
Yeah. Canada, U.S. It's the same thing.
Same thing.
I don't know. I won't complain if it's not too far away from me.
I mean, they do have the live stream on Porsche.com. It's up. It says 25 days, 15 hours. Like, it definitely seems like it's going down on September 4th.
All right. I haven't gotten an email from Porsche. I think maybe I got one during the podcast or something. But now I need to reach out because I'd like to be at that event, Porsche.
Yeah. No kidding. We have that guy, Dave Engelman, and other guys that have talked to us. So that'll be cool.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I don't think I'm going to be able to afford one of those cars. I mean, apparently the base price is going to be not that crazy, like $80,000 or something.
Yeah, and they were implying that they're going to have a rear-wheel drive model.
But that's going to be the rear-wheel drive model car, that's going to be further out. The first version and the fully equipped and the one that could be competitive with the Model S Ludicrous, that one's going to be expensive. I mean, they're talking about £130,000 they said on fully charged. So that's what? That's like $150,000 US. So that's what? That's 200,000 Canadians gonna be? Like it's like more expensive than my condo here.
Well, on that note.
Yeah, maybe I'll sell it and just live in the Taycan instead.
Right. It's got
sometimes I'll live in the Taycan, sometimes I'll live in the Model 3. Maybe I'll get the Model S from my parents and change that sometimes.
Could be fine. So speaking of that, I don't know what is going to happen next week because I'm going to be in France in a RV. So this might be the Fred show next week.
Yeah. No, you said you wanted to try anyway.
I want to try, but guarantees, we're not going to guarantee much here.
You're going to be in the RV and are you going to stop like at one of those camping stations and things like that?
We're going to have a campground. We're going to have, we're going to do the French outdoor thing. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure campground these days have Wi-Fi, right?
Oh, they better. They really better.
Oh, you're going to bring one of those hotspot?
Yeah, we have four different T-Mobile phones that work internationally. So
yeah, but the thing is with the video streaming and whatnot, it's harder with those things. But we're going to try. And if not, you guys are going to have to endure me for the whole show talking talking to you. Maybe you can ask us some questions because it always goes faster when it's just me. Or
yeah, maybe we'll have a Q&A next time.
Yeah,
but I have to say the Jitsi kind of worked pretty well.
Apparently so. People seem to be happy with it in the comments. Like no one's complained about the audio and the video. Although it doesn't, like I've seen the stream and it's not as crisp as it used to be, I think.
Yeah, there's a HD SD thing that keeps going switching back and forth. So no. Maybe I got to work on my wireless speed.
Okay, we're going to look at that. But at least it's a lot better than it was last week with that Skype call that was quite awful. All right, thanks a lot for tuning in, everyone. You can always subscribe to your podcast. Leave us a quick review and always help us. And subscribe on YouTube. And leave us a thumbs up if you like the show. Have a good one. Bye-bye.